Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
This one's from ZME Science, and it is identifying a new-to-us brain chemical that plays a major role in a decision that might sound familiar to some of you. To exercise or to snack?
I mean, ideally, it could be both. You, like, get on the treadmill, but you're eating ice cream. Like, is that... how does that work?
Sounds messy and delightful and a good contender for a future Olympics competition.
Yes.
But researchers at ETH Zurich have unveiled a new mechanism in the brain that mediates the decision between exercise and snacking. Apparently, these scientists were surprised to find that a chemical messenger called orexin plays a crucial role in this process. And they are hoping, as you've just kind of postulated, this insight could lead to new, more effective strategies meant to promote physical activity in populations that have been affected by the obesity epidemic, which is a very interesting way of wording that. So,
yeah, they mean Americans that just like...
just Americans. Right.
Yeah, we are affected by obesity. It's a very passive voice. Anyway, okay. But, you know, Switzerland, they're going to be real neutral with that language. Anyway, so for years, scientists have pondered what happens in our brains as we are standing at a crossroads. Do we run a couple of miles, or are we going to have that delicious milkshake? And orexin, which is also known as hypocretin, so yeah, I can understand the rebrand.
That's why it's got a new name.
It was discovered relatively recently, and in science terms, it's about 25 years ago. We're only just starting to clarify its functions now. And one of its most fascinating functions is the regulation of the sleep-wake cycle. For example, people with narcolepsy often lack orexin-producing neurons, and this leads to excessive daytime sleepiness, sudden muscle weakness known as cataplexy. But beyond its role in sleep, orexin also influences feeding behavior and energy homeostasis, as well as reward systems and addiction, which, whoo, they're getting a workout these days, huh?
Yeah, well, that seems like that covers everything.
Well, it's, you know, decision making.
Right.
Do I want to do the thing that I know I should do that's good for me, or do I want the cheap and easy accessible pleasure? Now, to be fair, the team conducted experiments on mice, so that's our source at this point. Mm-hmm. The way they did this is they offered rodents a few options, all of which they are known to like. You could have another mouse, different foods, a hiding place, and what they call a mouse treadmill, which is that little running wheel. And what they found, well, they were surprised to find that they were very interested in running on the wheel when they could eat or socialize instead. Even when we tried to distract them by giving them especially tasty food, they still chose to spend the same time running rather than make full use of the limited 10-minute food opportunity. So, according to the scientists, at first we were rather frustrated by the results because we were hoping to study something else, but the mice kept jumping on the treadmill instead. What they also found was that mice that had blocked orexin systems, they would opt for the milkshake over the exercise, proverbially speaking.
Right, and the mouse whatever that was.
Oh, no thanks. I mean, I know what you meant, milkshake for a mouse, not the other. Anyway, this suggests that when the blocked orexin system opts for the treat rather than exercise, they're thinking that rather than mediating how much the mice move or eat, they're thinking that orexin controls that decision-making process between the two options.
I don't know. Like, I feel like this could also just be speed. Like, what's the difference? Like, how do they know it's, like, the decision between food or exercise, you know, for their own benefit versus, like, I gotta run.
Yeah. How is it a decision and not a compulsion?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. And that's why we need to do some more studies, right? Figure out, you know, do we examine patients that may have a restricted orexin system? Is it for genetic reasons? Maybe they have drugs that happen to be blocking orexin. But hey, if it helps us make better decisions, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if it is speed, it's probably good for me to get on the treadmill one way or the other. So.
All right. Next link.
Okay. Strap in, because this is a little bit of a wild one. Coming from ArsTechnica.com, this article is titled, In World First, Russian Chess Player Poisons Rival's Board with Mercury.
Whoa. Yeah.
The board? Man, they love their poison over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Russia is no stranger to unique poisonings. State agents have been known to use everything from polonium-laced tea to the deadly nerve agent Novichok when making assassination attempts against both defectors and internal political rivals like Alexei Navalny. But a new first in the long history of poisonings was opened this month in the Russian Republic of Dagestan, where a 40-something chess player named Amina Abakarova attempted to poison a rival by depositing liquid mercury on and around her chessboard. Oliver Carroll, a Ukraine war correspondent, summed up the situation with some social media snark. I know that on the standards of Russian doping, it's perhaps only a 7 out of 10, but still.
That's a passing grade.
So, the strange story began on August 2nd when a regional chess tournament was taking place in Makhachkala, a Russian town on the Caspian Sea just north of Azerbaijan. Emergency services were called after 30-year-old Umayganat Osmanova fell ill during a chess match. Osmanova said she had seen some tiny gray or silver beads rolling out from beneath her side of the chessboard, but this apparently didn't seem odd until she began to feel unwell. A chess.com story translated some of Osmanova's remarks about what happened. She said, I still feel bad. In the first minutes, I felt a lack of air and a taste of iron in my mouth. Such symptoms are consistent with exposure to elemental mercury, the liquid or quicksilver version of mercury sometimes used in thermometers. According to the Cleveland Clinic, this form of mercury is usually harmless if you touch or swallow it because its slippery texture won't absorb into your skin or intestines. But if you breathe in any of it, watch out, symptoms occur immediately and can include coughing, breathing trouble, nausea, bleeding gums, and a metallic taste in your mouth.
Huh.
Which I did not know. That's like kind of crazy. I always thought mercury was one of those, like, you know, you touch it and it's like lead or whatever, like it's in your bloodstream now, but like you have to breathe it in. That's wild.
Interesting. Yeah, because there's all those people in like the 18th century or whatever who were straight up drinking it and slowly dying. But apparently if they had just breathed a much smaller amount, they were done.
Yeah.
Huh.
So tournament officials consulted security camera footage where they saw Abakarova walking through a nearly empty room of chess tables some 20 minutes before play was to begin. In one news account, she had been asking casually beforehand whether there were any such cameras in the venue. In the footage, she walked over to one particular table, pulled a small vial from her bag, and appeared to smear something on the pieces and the table itself.
Wow.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you watched the video?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Like, I'm only seeing a screen cap, and you're just like, she is sure fiddling with that chessboard over there and standing awful close to it.
Well, she thought there were no cameras, y'all. She had, she'd asked.
And they were honest. So the security camera footage was soon released onto the internet, and you can now watch it on YouTube. One news outlet claims that she admitted to police that the mercury she used came from thermometers. The president of the Russian Chess Federation, Andrei Filatov, temporarily suspended Abakarova from competitions until the conclusions of the case against her, at which point she could face a lifetime ban from competitive chess. That seems light.
That and jail time, I mean.
The source of Abakarova's dispute with Osmanova remains unclear. One Russian news outlet said that the two had known each other for years but had recently fought. And in this version of the story, Abakarova showed up to one recent match with a phone, which is against the rules. Osmanova was upset but did not tell the judges. She could have been grateful that I didn't make a fuss and forgave her, Osmanova said. Instead, Amina refused to shake my hand during the competition last week. Chessbase said the dispute was over a recent match between the two in which both players scored the same number of points, but the victory was awarded to Osmanova based on additional factors. And another Telegram channel says the issue was about negative statements made by Osmanova about Abakarova and her family members. But whatever the source of the conflict, Abakarova now faces the prospect of several years in prison, and the world of chess just got meaner.
Well, you know, she might get offered a promotion to work at the KGB or something.
Yeah.
Well, she wasn't very good at it.
That's true. She got caught. True. She was trying to clean it up, y'all. She saw the mercury on the table and was trying to prevent a tragedy.
Yeah, she was just the fixer.
Yeah, she saw I, Tanya. She didn't want that for herself.
So a little bit of a tangent, but I was very curious about Novichok, and there's actually this wild detail. So the link in this article goes to the Salisbury poisonings, which happened in the UK and was a botched assassination attempt, and it didn't really succeed. They were both hospitalized in critical conditions, but after that, another person died from this poisoning about like 3 months later because this man, Charlie Rowley, found a perfume bottle out of a trash bin and then wrapped it and gave it to his girlfriend as a gift.
Oh, no.
And she sprayed it on her wrist and she got ill within 15 minutes and died a week later.
Wow. Trash perfume. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
And you have to do better.
It's just insane. And I mean, he got sick too, but he was fine. So don't do that.
Yeah, don't go dumpster diving, man. What are you doing?
So yeah, that's another very grim detail for you, because I know this article needed a little bit more spice, right?
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, this next story might explain some of this. Mm. This comes from the Popular Science. Study confirms that thinking hard is unpleasant. You heard that right. They had to study that. Which I'm sure was very unpleasant for
them. Were the scientists just like pouting the whole time they did this work?
According to new research from the American Psychological Association, mental exertion appears to be associated with various unpleasant feelings and emotion in several taxing situations. So Eric Bilgeleveld, a study co-author and psychologist at Roundbound University in the Netherlands, said, quote, "Managers often encourage employees and teachers often encourage students to exert mental effort. On the surface, this seems to work well. Employees and students do often opt for mentally challenging activities. From this, you may be tempted to conclude that employees and students tend to enjoy thinking hard. Our results suggest that this conclusion would be false. In general, people really dislike mental effort."
I mean,
no kidding. In the study, the team conducted a meta-analysis of 170 studies across 29 countries. So that's where we can feel a little bit better. Hmm. At first, I thought it would just be America.
Right.
Like, well, yeah, no kidding. But it's global. They included college students, amateur athletes, engineers, teachers, and those who work in a military or healthcare setting. The team looked at 358 different cognitive tasks, practicing a golf swing, learning to use a new tech, navigating an unfamiliar environment, playing a virtual reality game, and more. Participants in all the studies have reported how much effort they exerted and the extent to which they experienced irritation, frustration, annoyance, or stress. Their findings show that mental effort feels unpleasant across a wide range of populations, which is important for professionals such as engineers, educators, to keep in mind when designing tasks, tools, interfaces, apps, materials, or instructions. When they're required to exert substantial mental effort, they need to be rewarded for that effort.
Mm.
One notable finding was that while the association between mental effort and adverse feelings was still significant, it was less pronounced in studies conducted in Asian countries.
Hmm. Well, or they had just been conditioned to never, ever talk about their negative feelings.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, it's a very slippery slope towards some racist conclusions. So we're moving on. Humans continue to do hard things anyway, partially because the more effort something takes, the more our species tends to value it.
Hmm.
Looking at you, AI art. A 2022 study proposed that this could be because rewarding the effort, not the outcome, prompted more difficult tasks later without the rewards.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case. Like, they've done studies where if you tell a child, "You're so smart," then as soon as they come against something that's hard, they're like, "Oh, I'm an idiot." But if you tell a child, "You worked so hard," then they feel like, well, it's me. I have the control over that. I can work hard and do better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. You praise the process, not the output.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, which is what I try to do in my teaching practice. Definitely don't just regurgitate back to me. Try to put it in your own words. What does it mean to you?
Mm-hmm. Except for some of those jerk students where you're like, "You just suck. Yeah, I hate you."
And then we just move on.
Right.
Also, too, I think some people just like thinking hard. They like the pain of thinking hard. They're mental masochists, if you will.
Well, yeah, it's exactly like the exercise. I think even hardcore athletes, if you ask them, "Do you want to run 10 miles and do 100 sit-ups?" They'll be like, "Well, no, I'm going to be miserable while that's happening, but I feel good when it's done." And I think it's the same thing. You get a reward from the accomplishment, even if it's hard while you're doing it.
But the study should have included that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, again, thinking hard is hard. So stop doing it. Just
no,
sit back and listen to our next link.
Just chill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
next link.
All right. Well, I've got one that's maybe kind of instinctively gross, but really shouldn't be if you think about it. It's from fizz.org, and it's called Testing the Viability of Using Horse Milk to Make Ice Cream.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Horse milk.
Angie's sounded right in the middle.
Right. And you might think at first glance that this should be a pretty straightforward process that doesn't require a whole team of researchers, because we know how to make ice cream with cow's milk, so just trade one ingredient for the other and it should work. Unfortunately, it doesn't, for the same reason that you can't make cheese out of horse milk, or indeed a lot of other mammals' milks. And it has to do with the fat content. Cow's milk has a lot of it, and even then, you have to combine a much larger amount of cream than would naturally occur in the milk in order to get that semi-frozen consistency. Because you can freeze plain cow's milk and it just gets hard like ice. It's the fat content that makes it ice cream, and horse milk just doesn't have it. But from a nutritional standpoint, if you could make various dairy products out of horse milk, it would be a lot better, both for us and the environment. Many cultures around the world do consume horse milk in its liquid form, and studies have shown that its nutritional profile is actually much closer to human milk than cow's milk is. Which, side note, this isn't discussed in the article, but it's kind of a soapbox issue for me. Pretty much all milks are closer to human milk than cow's milk is. Like, we've chosen the worst possible one.
But it's so fatty.
I know, and that's exactly why we love it, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking to substitute, the best one is actually camel milk.
What?
Yeah, I know. Oh. It's almost identical, and it's nutritionally complete for humans, meaning you can live on nothing but camel's milk indefinitely. And we know that because there are, in fact, cultures who do, especially nomadic tribes in the Middle East, yeah, who used to go on these months-long journeys across the desert, and all they had to do was bring one mother camel with them, and they'd have all the food they needed. Anyway, soapbox back into the bed. We're talking about horse milk here, which, as the article notes, does contain a bunch of beneficial enzymes and proteins that are not found in cow's milk. But when it comes to ice cream, again, we've got that fat problem. And unfortunately, the researchers did find that they were unable to make horse milk ice cream without adding at least a little bit of cream from cow's milk. Mm. But even a partial replacement is better than nothing. So they continued forward and they found that they could use less cream if they introduced some probiotic bacteria to help thicken the horse milk cow's cream combo. So for the latest round of experimentation, the team at West Pomeranian University of Technology in Poland created 4 batches of ice cream. The first used the standard probiotics you would use for yogurt made from cow's milk. The second used those same bacteria plus a prebiotic fiber called inulin. The third used a species called Lacticaceae bacillus rhamnosu. And the fourth used Lactoplantabacillus. They then gave these samples to 60 volunteers for a taste test. And the consensus was that all 4 of them were, quote, creamy and attractive with good taste and texture, though participants did say that the batch with inulin was slightly more acidic than they would prefer. So the conclusion they're making here is that we can, if we want to, make ice cream with some percentage of horse milk and have it be acceptable to consumers, which, like, maybe, I don't know. I think there's definitely some self-selection going on with the volunteers. I don't know if
the
average person...
I mean, did they tell them that they were eating horse milk consumption?
I think, maybe not. Maybe they just said, here's some ice cream alternatives. But at the very least, it's people who are willing to consider alternatives. Mm-hmm. And I think if you had horse milk in the dairy aisle, I don't think people would be super on board with that. But maybe the times are coming. You know, we got cricket flour.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting choice, too, of like, okay, you want milk alternatives. Are you going to go for like synthetic plant-based alternatives, or which animal in the animal kingdom do you want to try milk from?
Well, and it sort of brings you back around to like, why do we think cow's milk is totally cool, but other animals' milk is disgusting? It's like, it's all milk.
It's
either all disgusting or none of it is.
Right.
I also feel like I'm skeptical about their environmental claims because I'm also like, yeah, but we don't factory farm horses. If we did use horse milk a lot, we probably would. And then we'd be feeding them terrible things and it would just be a different animal ruining the environment. So
what about wolf's milk?
There you go.
It worked for Romulus and Remus.
That's right. How do you think they built Rome? It wasn't on a cow. God.
Not cow milk. It was wolf milk.
It was wolf teeth. Oh, my goodness.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, let's stay weird with Scientific American's article about slime mold.
Mm.
Specifically, how slime mold is helping to map the universe's tendrils of dark matter.
Oh.
What?
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Part of it is because this single-celled organism has unique pathfinding instincts. And it starts off with this lovely picture of a slime mold with these kind of veiny tendrils.
Lovely picture of mold.
It's kind of beautiful. It has a very, like, silly string look to it. And it's also, mm-hmm. if you've been on the internet at all this summer, it's very brat.
Uh-huh.
So over billions of years, gravity has pulled the universe's matter into a chaotic netting of filaments, tendrils, and voids. That's what we call the cosmic web.
Mm.
And galaxies are strewn along these strands, like beads on a string, if you will. So New Mexico State University astronomer Farhanul Hassan and his colleagues wondered how environments created by the filaments affect the evolution of galaxies. To find out, the researchers needed to accurately map the cosmic web over time. But it's a mixture of gas, galaxies, and not to mention all that dark matter, makes it kind of hard because we can't see a lot of this. How do we even measure? Yeah.
Then I'm pretty sure it's pretty big.
Exactly.
There's a lot of data there. Yeah.
But that's why we have computers. And in order to do this in the way they wanted, Hassan and his colleagues brought in a special collaborator, a species of the humble slime mold. Now, scientists have used slime mold's exploration prowess to solve mazes, to solve logic puzzles, to even recreate transportation systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great mapping algorithm because it's not really biased by the first direction you decide to look in. Slime molds are capable of exploring everything at once. That came from New Jersey Institute of Technology slime mold specialist Simon Garnier. Now, Hassan and his team gave a slime mold-based algorithm a set of galaxies' positions as food, if you will, and then said, go ahead and map connections across this simulated universe at various time points. And what they found was that the slime mold map created a cleaner filament structure than any human-designed algorithm they had tried.
Huh.
The researchers found that neither proximity nor thickness of the universe's filaments seemed to affect the galaxies early on. But as the universe matured, material pulled into the web eventually disrupted star formations in galaxies that were too close. And conclusions from the simulated universe eventually can be tested against older glimpses of the real cosmic web. They're hoping that this slime mold algorithm can map it all.
I'm happy to use slime molds in every facet of my life. Bring them on.
I think we have one in our bathroom.
No. We're not willing that into being. No.
Different slime mold.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Nature.com's titled, Your Microwave Oven Has Its Own Microbiome.
Oh,
I was so much happier not thinking about this. All right.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you're like, that makes sense. Ew. And then once I read this, I was like, well, you know, I'm pretty sure every part of my house has its own microbiome,
yes.
but some of them are worse than others. So
yeah, I mean, this one's getting irradiated constantly. So it's the strongest of the strong.
Yes. So on that note, extremophiles are organisms that can survive and even thrive in the harshest of environments, including scorching hydrothermal vents, sub-zero Antarctic ice, and the crushing pressures of Earth's crust. So now they've been discovered in a more pedestrian setting, microwave ovens. And although previous studies found distinct communities of microbes in kitchen appliances such as dishwashers and coffee machines, this is the first time that the microwave oven has been investigated for having its own microbiome. The research published August 8th in Frontiers in Microbiology adds to existing work challenging a common misconception that microwave radiation heats up and completely kills bacteria that cause foodborne illness, such as E. coli and Salmonella. Jason Tetro, a freelance microbiologist known as the Germ Guy in Edmonton, Canada, says, we've all been taught from like the 1980s that if you use a microwave oven, it kills everything. He says this study is important because it shines a spotlight on potential pathogens in these appliances, especially shared ones.
Hmm.
So Alba Iglesias, a microbiologist at the University of Valencia in Spain, and her colleagues swabbed 30 microwave ovens, including some in households, some in large spaces such as offices, and some used in laboratories to heat specimens and chemical solutions. A total of 101 bacterial strains grew in the cultures. The dominant ones belong to the Bacillus, Micrococcus, and Staphylococcus genera, which commonly live on human skin and surfaces that people frequently touch. Human skin bacteria were present in all three types of microwave oven, but were more abundant in the household and shared use appliances. A few bacteria types associated with foodborne illnesses, including Klebsiella and Brevendemonas, also grew in some of the cultures from household microwaves. Laboratory microwave ovens contain the greatest genetic diversity of bacteria. The team suggests that the extremophile strains they found in the microwave ovens might have been selected evolutionarily by surviving repeated rounds of radiation and could have biotechnological applications, such as in the bioremediation of toxic waste. But for the general public, the implications of the study are simpler. Study co-author Manuel Porcar, who's a microbiologist also at the University of Valencia, says a microwave is not a pure, pristine place. It's also not a pathogenic reservoir to be feared, he says, but he does recommend cleaning your kitchen microwave just as often as you would scrub your kitchen surfaces to eliminate potential bacteria.
Okay, so like once a year.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe just get the chunks of food out of it. Like if you got some splatter on the ceiling, maybe get that off.
Yeah.
Or this is the new Tamagotchi. Develop it. Harness it. Let it grow. Tell it what you want it to do. Your new super extremophile could be your new familiar. Why not?
Yeah.
Gently rock your microwave. Get those friendship points. Anyways, next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from The Conversation. Kind of another obvious one here for us, but readers trust journalists less when they debunk rather than confirm claims.
Blame the messenger.
seems obvious, and we might be thinking to ourselves, yeah, not me, but yeah, me.
Yeah, everybody.
We are all guilty of these. Some linguists and social scientists' theories suggest that people intuitively understand social expectations not to be negative. Being disagreeable, like when pointing out someone else's error, carries with it a lot of risk of backlash. In other words, if you're providing a correction, you're a bit of a schmuck. Nobody likes the, well, actually guy.
Yeah, you're already a jerk. And then fundamentally, now I have to assess what you've said, aside from the fact that I don't like you.
So using real articles, they investigated how people feel about journalists who provide, quote, fact checks. In their first study, participants read a detailed fact check that either corrected or confirmed some claims related to politics or economics. For instance, one focused on the statement, congressional salaries have gone up 231% in the past 30 years, which is false. Although people were fairly trusting of the journalist in general, more people expressed suspicion towards journalists providing corrections than those providing confirmations. In the second study, they presented marketing claims that ultimately proved to be true or false. For example, some participants read an article about a brand that said its cooking hacks would save time, but they actually didn't work. Others read articles about a brand providing cooking hacks that turned out to be genuine. Again, across several types of products, people thought they needed more evidence in order to believe articles pointing out falsehoods.
Well, I mean, hear me out, though. I don't know that that's a terrible thing. Because if you have like two strangers in front of you giving you information about something you genuinely know nothing about, and one says the answer is A and the other says B, you're at a zero effectively. And so, yeah, you do need more information. If you have two people both telling you A, then it's like, yeah, I've got at least two pieces of data that say it's A. So you're feeling a lot more confident at two than you are at zero.
But that's assuming people are gathering information to use in a logical, strategic, critical thinking manner versus
I need more information
so I can find the voice that's going to corroborate mine and then conveniently dismiss all of the debunking that makes me feel unpleasant, right?
Yeah, and journalists can maybe be a little bit more transparent. Showing people how they got their evidence can sometimes help.
Yeah.
But again, what they discovered was, not even that helped.
No.
Because trust at the end of the day is contingent on what the conclusion is.
Okay. Well, I would just like to say as a public service announcement, everything Bradley said is wrong. And you can visit my blog for more. Or so, I don't know.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I'm on a bit of a theme today, as it turns out, because this next article is also about horses. It's from The Guardian, and it's called Horses Can Plan Ahead and Think Strategically, Scientists Find. So this is new research coming from Nottingham Trent University in the UK, And the big thing they've kind of established here is not just that horses are smart and can learn how to play games in order to get a reward, which we've known for a long time, but that they are clever enough to circumvent the rules and be as lazy as possible while still getting the reward.
Yeah.
Or to put it more scientifically, according to lead researcher Louise Evans, previous research suggested that horses simply respond to stimuli in the moment, whereas our study shows that they have an awareness of the consequences and outcomes of their actions. So the study had three stages, with 20 horses participating in all three. First, they were given a treat if they simply touched their nose to a little card. Once they'd all learned how to do that, the researchers implemented a stoplight. And from that point forward, the horses were only given a treat if they touched the card when the light was off. And the horses didn't actually change their behavior. They just kept touching the card when they felt like it, and sometimes they got a treat and sometimes they didn't. But then in the third stage, researchers added in a penalty for wrong choices. If the horses touched the card while the stoplight was on, they would be completely unable to play the game for 10 seconds. And instantly, the horses all began to touch the card only at the right time. Evans says this indicates that the horses did understand the rules all along. They just didn't care. As for why this is important, Evans believes that understanding what animals are cognitively capable of usually results in better welfare for those animals in captivity. She said, quote, "What we've shown is that in training, you really don't need to use aversive methods or anything too harsh to get really good performance out of horses." Mm-hmm. Basically, there's a difference between a stubborn horse and a lazy horse, and most horses will do what you're asking, but only if you make it worth their while, which, you know, same with people, honestly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't be a jerk. Yep.
Thinking is hard. I need a reward.
Yeah,
exactly. You want me to touch a card? I need something. I need a milkshake. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Fisherman lands first ever lost Lego shark, Banksy confirms seventh London artwork in a week, and researchers worry about AI turning humans into jerks. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.